This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Return to the source, the introduction. The subject tonight is love, and for tomorrow night as well. As a matter of fact, I know no better topic for us to discuss until we die. Hafiz. To test, I recite this old tale, the main story, a fish story. Once there was a fish who lived in the great ocean, and because the water was transparent and always conveniently got out of the way of his nose when he moved along, he didn't know he was in the ocean. Well, one day the fish did a very dangerous thing. He began to think, surely I'm a most remarkable being since I can move around like this in the middle of empty space. Then the fish became confused because of thinking about moving and swimming, and he suddenly had an anxiety attack and thought he had forgotten how. At that moment, he looked down and saw the yawning chasm of the ocean's depths, and he was terrified that he would drop. Then he thought, if I could catch hold of my tail in my mouth, I could hold myself up. And so he curled himself up and started snapping at his tail. Unfortunately, his spine wasn't quite supple enough, so he kept missing. And as he went on trying to catch hold of his tail, the yawning black abyss below became even more terrible, and he was brought to the edge of a total nervous breakdown. The fish was about to give up, when the ocean, which had been watching the whole time with mixed feelings of pity and amusement, said, what are you doing? What are you doing? Oh, said the fish, I'm terrified of falling into the dark abyss, and I'm trying to catch hold of my tail in my mouth to hold myself up. So, the ocean said, well, you've been trying that for a long time now, and still you haven't fallen down. How come? How come? Of course I haven't fallen down yet, because I'm swimming. I'm swimming. Well, came the reply, I am the great ocean in which you live and move and are able to be a fish, and I give all of myself to you so you may swim and support you all the time you are swimming. But here you are, instead of exploring the length, breadth, and depth and height of my expanse, you waste your time pursuing your own end. From then on, the fish put his own tail behind him, his own end behind him, where it belonged, and set out to explore the ocean. Verse. Moving out of the head, into and through the heart, one recognizes the source immediately. One sees how each serves and can use each knowingly. When we trust and relax, loving kindness will prevail. Support will prevail. We will experience that we are never apart from the great oceanic nature that we are. Leaving go of snapping at our tail, the world will stop spinning, and we can freely explore. Hey, have you heard the news? Under the canopy in your own temple, Prajna and Karuna have been married for a long time. Of course we haven't fallen. Swimming, swimming. It's one of my favorite tales. I took a walk during rest practice and was just so absorbed along with the trees and the land and the way the rain saturates everything and brings out this kind of deep, deep elegance. It's so deep and dark and riveting, and things that I pass all the time are showing a whole new face. Like, I never met some of these trees that I'm seeing. It's been a while. And my impulse was I wanted to give everyone a paintbrush. There was a very juicy, muddy puddle. And just paintbrush and paper to just touch these lines, touch these crevices, and touch our life in the same way. It's not different from on our seat. We're the same. We are these deep, mysterious creatures with folds and weathers and the skins and this constant movement and change. So I moved among them and on them, which was so delicious. Dido used to call some of these ways things revealing their else-ness. So sometimes we see things and we hold them in what we think they are, and suddenly if we stay with something long enough, like our zazen, things are revealed for what else they are. I was reminded of Dogen saying, the moment you sit down, that is wakefulness. When we turn towards ourselves, he has the equation, practice equals enlightenment. As soon as we practice, that is the enlightened mind, the saturated enlightened mind moving through. I was also remembering after a long canoe canoe trip with the women, we did a hike. There was a mountain at our place. It was a beautiful lake. And there was a mountain, Mount Frederica. And it wasn't huge, which I was very happy about. I don't like going up so much. I like flat, but anyway. We went to the top of Mount Frederica and just spent time up there seeing like all the lakes that we were on, like this whole view, just astounding. And it was pretty hot. We didn't have much rain, so we came down. And of course, we had the canoe back to our island. And then we all just wanted to get in the water and swim. And at our site, there was a mom and a couple of catfish. And they had just had babies. We thought they were tadpoles, and they were eating them until somebody looked really close and realized they all had whiskers. So they were all tadpoles. And they were swimming in circles. I don't know what they were doing, collecting the babies or moving them about. And so we could walk out in the sand and keep getting deeper and deeper into the water. At first you can see through the water. It was kind of a maple syrup kind of coloring. And then it just turned darker and darker and darker until you couldn't really see any longer. And there was one point we were all out there and kind of formed a big circle. You could just see our heads. And we were all treading water, of course, cracking up and laughing hysterically. And at one point, I was like treading. And at one point, I put my feet down and I was only up to my shoulders. And I was astounded. Like the feeling of Like, I thought I was in this super deep water, and I realized, like, it was not that far, and I could stand and be supported right there. Very great feeling. So living a practice life, choosing this as we have, choosing to come here, it's all the time. You know, you can say, and I've thought this, like maybe I'd be better off if I just didn't find this, because then we have to practice all the time. You can't like not, once you turn towards it, it's very hard to turn away and turn off. We try, but where are you going to go? Where else can we go? So it's not just on the cushion, and it's not just when something upsets us. So the more we include and see all that occurs in our life as a practice opportunity, within that we can make a really deep, saturated satisfaction. A deep refuge of contact with an intelligence that is always taking place, even though we don't know it. That's what it is to practice. We don't know it, but we turn towards and absorb ourselves. It allows us to release this snapping tail. You know, I also thought about, you know, all the jokes, I'm sure, but somebody asked a centipede once, what do you do with all those legs? And suddenly it couldn't walk, right? It didn't really think about 100 or 1,000 legs or whatever many. It just walked. But when someone asked, what do you do with all those legs? Couldn't walk. Like asking Avalokiteshvara, what do you do with all your hands and arms? It's like reaching back for a pillow in the night. Right? Don't even think about it. So detours and obstacles, as we worked on in our retreat on the Four Immeasurables, are facts of life on the path of liberation. And why it's great to work with someone is because, you know, if somebody's been in practice a long time, they've hit a lot of detours, a lot of potholes, a lot of obstacles, until we learn how to navigate them. At first, they feel like unpassable sometimes, right? When we're sitting there with ourself and something comes that's strong, it feels like we're stamped for the rest of our life. Some rise out of our own psychology and conditioning. We judge ourselves and we hold these ideals of perfectionism, or we procrastinate tomorrow, later. Or we seek diversions. And then there are the more universal obstacles that nearly every practitioner faces. That if we see them clearly and how they manifest, it will really open up how we practice. I created a new word called death initiations. Death initiations, like definitions, which it's a death initiation to our definitions. And it brings us to not knowing. So that's what happens on our seat. All the definitions of the definitions begin to crumble. So I wanted to speak about three obstacles or detours in particular that I think are really hot. One is not understanding the magnitude and power of the state that we may live in most of the time, which is identified with or lost in our thoughts, emotions. In the first place, it's important to recognize that there is an addiction to our thoughts. I'll speak for myself, but I think I'm speaking for you too. And we love our thoughts because, after all, they're mine. And I'm the star of my show. It's not so much that we have them, but the trouble comes when we believe our ideas and thoughts as the truth. And at least when we don't press into them and see if what we're believing right now that seems so deep and real and true, is it? Is it? When we really look at it, can we be that honest? But you see, when we really are addicted and we love it, we almost don't want to see it's not true, because something has to go. Something has to crumble. A cherished something. If we really look there, we see that this is an overlay that we put on the world, that we put on everything. Not to bemoan it. This is the good news from seeing it. We also have trouble controlling our emotions, or we're told not to have them. You're too emotional. I don't have enough. How many of us have gotten that from someone? You're too emotional. Mostly women get that, I think, but I don't know, maybe you guys get that too. The painful thoughts that arise, we may even say we love them. I recognize some deep feelings that have been with me for so long are so etched in my pathways, in my mind. It's the more and more I see of it, I'm just like, wow, the propensity and the strength of a habit in the pathways of the mind. Some of them are so well worn. So it does take a tremendous leap. And that's why we have a practice. Every time you return to breath, to your practice, that is actually a leap. That's the leap. I mean, this is interdependence, not independence with fireworks. It's very basic. Calm. And when I withdraw, I literally feel the death, the abyss, so profoundly. I feel lost or like I'm falling. Now, right there, many of us launch an attack on ourselves. The critic kicks in. We're messed up. We're probably the only one in this room that's not getting it. Everybody is doing it but me. I have a defect, I'm positive. So we go back to breath. You know, somebody was speaking this morning about the beauty of the ugliness. And I was thinking of Sokmi Rinpoche, who says we have to keep meeting our beautiful monsters. They're like little monsters, but they're so beautiful. And they just want some sweet nectar from us. They just want us to feed them something. They're calling out in a critical way because they need our love. They need our kindness. That's all. It's just an us. We see in our practice how we can't seem to stay present in the present moment for more than a few seconds. You know, William James says it's 4 seconds that we can stay in the present moment before, he speaks of a bird on a tree limb before it takes flight. Now that flight is the part that we have to work with, because it can fly for all morning, all afternoon, a couple years, a lifetime before it comes back onto that tree limb to the present moment. We like filling our space with something. So in the breath practice, the gap at the end of the exhale is a space you can allow, space of mind. You let it out before you take that next, if you're following, counting. In that space, let that space give you a spaciousness of mind. And as Trungpa would say, till your life turns into gap, 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 gap. Just gap. Just gap. Buddhism teaches that we are all born with the Buddha nature. We're all born with these qualities, these virtues that are good. Good. Really good. So please recognize your good seeds too. We're not just the bad seeds. We seem to be more addicted to that and gravitate to our bad seeds, but it's okay to recognize a good seed. Many of them. Now, just be careful you don't just, you know, rest on your laurels, so to speak, and build another cocoon there. But it's a good thing that we can allow our true nature to reveal itself, yet despite how strong the aspiration is to follow this, if we don't see the magnitude of how identified and consumed we are with being preoccupied, we'll just keep being blindsided. So it's just to recognize that way of being, just to recognize that that is something that we all work with. Another hot, big obstacle we encounter in practice is resistance. Look at your day so far. Has there been any resistance? Fires are burning. We don't like pain. Lately, not right at this moment, which is nice, I've been feeling like I'm between a giant's fingers, just getting squeezed. I'm sorry if that's gross, but sometimes it's called between a rock and a hard place. And I really was looking at that phrase, between a rock and a hard place. Like, that's where we are. So there's this rock and then a hard place, and we're like between a rock and a hard place. Uncomfortable, in other words. Sometimes we encounter this yawning chasm. And now, through the power of my practice, I have some insight to experience what is happening. The habit of my mind to create myself in particular familiar ways of perfectionism and judgment, because to release to the great ocean feels so utterly different and uncertain, which is actually more real. To be uncertain, that's more true. You know, we're from a culture of I know, and you have to be sure. And it's debilitating. It's like we're not starting with a culture of we all don't really know and then have our opinions. It's kind of another way around. So go into a job and be vulnerable and true and say, I don't really know, like as a virtue. It's like, off the list, someone else. We want people who are so sure. So I encourage you to not be so sure you've got the job. You've already got it. My ideals and the reality of what's happening don't match. It feels like this giant has me between his fingers and is squeezing my juices out. And you know what those juices are? My goodness. My goodness. It's making me really practice to see what's real and true. That's how I choose to work with myself. That's what I've learned from this tradition, from the thousands of ancestors and humans who have encountered their own mind for a path of liberation. You know, Shuganoff Sensei would say, like Roshi, you know, we read a koan, you know, the door slammed, he broke his toe, and poof, it all opened up. Like, it's like, you don't realize, like, this guy's been practicing for like 40 years, hitting the potholes and the detours and crying and resisting and wanting to quit and not do this anymore. Why is it worth it? How do you know if it's working? Just look and see if there's some measure of freedom and goodness that has already come to you. Can you feel the support of this universe? There's often a discrepancy between our ideals and what we actually encounter. Like in Zazen, have you noticed how hard it is to feel an emotion without getting swept away in it? Getting totally swept away. How difficult it is to be kind to ourselves when we're miserable, when we're in panic mode, when we're caught up. Do we think to practice that? Do we think to practice? What is that? There is a generous, true generous reality that is present. It may not seem like that in this world, but that is always with us. A true generous reality. Just look at the sky, look at the trees, look at another person. You'll see it all over. And even if it gets in a hair, that's enough. The times we experience big squeeze are usually the most productive places, in particular on the journey of awakening, the heart and mind. I think it's worth talking about because we find ourselves in this place again and again. And usually we want to run for our lives. So if you want to run for your lives, that's a sign that there's something really important ripening. So if you can turn the slightest bit, find the slightest generosity in reality, you will be supported to move through, to stop snapping at the tail. It's extremely uncomfortable, and we can't wiggle out, you know. You see it on cartoons, you know, when somebody, a giant King Kong picks someone up and they're like, la, 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 you know, and you just can't get out of the grips. It's like a mosquito. You know, if I tried to bite King Kong, it's like a mosquito bite probably. It reminded me of, like, I love when, I don't have a dog, but I love when you have a rubber toy and a dog, and you get a dog to bite it, right? And you're real close to his nose, and he holds it, he grips it, and he loves this resistance, like, and you can, like, pet his nose while he's going, like, and you're doing it, and he's, like, jerking it, like, from you, right? And you're just, like, and you can go, like, dee, 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 da, 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 and he's just, like, got it, like, so tenaciously, again and again. That's what the feeling is like to me with some of these thoughts. I feel like I'm like, and like, you know, the universe is like petting me and tickling me, and I'm like, again and again. And the more resistance, the more the grip. They love it. And let go for a minute, poof, back at it, and you start all over again. So we can't underestimate the degree to which resistance is predictable and an inevitable part of practice life. And it comes in many forms. Not wanting to sit, not wanting to stay with our experience for more than a few seconds, spinning off into thinking and some other time, past, later, fantasy, suppressing or avoiding emotional pain, and finding fault with almost everything. Ourselves, everyone, the paper towels, our clothing. Yeah. That was another fantasy I had, was when it was pouring, I just wanted all of us to go out and get drenched. But then I thought of the pile of clothes afterwards and the inability to dry things except for in the dryer. But when was the last time in rains like this that you went out and got drenched? That's the feeling of zazen and practice, is to just get drenched through and through. Just let it take you away to the core. So think of the rain. Let it just be as natural as that. But we have to encounter these obstacles, we do, to know the other, what's possible, that generosity that comes. We can even see our resistance and our commitment to believing debilitating thoughts, right? As this is too hard, I'm the worst, right? Everyone else seems to be, I said, fill in the blank. And the resistance to not invite these beautiful monsters into our housewarming party. Housewarming party. We're friendly hosts. Does anybody come to our party that we won't let in? And another really subtle resistance is thinking and talking about practice rather than actually experiencing our life. To think and talk about it, actually, I find is a subtle way of moving from the real effort that is required to cultivate what it is I need to practice to liberate the thoughts. Liberate the one who is keeping it all bound up. That's what thinking and talking about it does. It would mean releasing into what we don't know. Surrendering. Surrendering to uncertainty. Maybe another way to come to it. I don't know. When we have those debilitating, obsessive, I don't know. That's fine. That's true. That's generous. that's loving. The unknown. I play a strange game where I resist facing what is present and just relax because I'm still struggling with a view of how I think I'm supposed to be. It's one of my, has been a favorite full-length feature at the movies, on the screen. Can you imagine if what was in our mind in a period of zazen we projected on a screen here? It's a strange thing we do. We're strange, mysterious beings. So don't box yourself in to I am. We hold on to our beliefs that no longer serve because it's familiar. We don't want to give up our illusions, even though they make us miserable. Right? Snap, snap, snap. To see what we do with honesty and gentleness. This kutz I was given reminds me of my gentleness. It reminds me of a Pisces, for one thing. This goes this way and this way. But it's so, I could snap this sucker like really easily. It's driftwood, if you want to say where it came from. And it's so perfect that I have it because a lot of my tension is in my hands. And I, you know, besides, like, if I want to bite my nails, or I'm always, I could, you know, just grip tightly. Maybe that's why I'm a potter. It requires that sort of very refined balance of pushing, letting go, and pushing. That's how you raise a pot, is you have the center of gravity. It's just like zazen. You're on a spinning wheel. Sound familiar? And you're trying to center a lump that's like totally, like, you know, wobbly, and hopefully it's lined up before you sit down. You do your best to wedge it and align the molecules as we do as we arrange our body into our seated posture. And then gravity is finding us a center, and you have to use the right pressures at the right time with the right amount. You have to both push in and down at the same time, squeeze and release, and you have to feed that the whole time, and you have to stretch. You can't munge a pot. You can, but what gives the pot the life, the volume, the breath, is in the squeeze, is how we meet the squeeze. That's what brings it alive. My friend was telling me about her child's reoccurring nightmares. And I've had something like this. Some of you may have ferocious monsters chasing us through the house. And whenever she closed a door, the monster would just bam, right through. It's horrifying in your sleep. Like you're shutting these doors and the sucker's just coming through, coming through. And so she said they were huge, hairy, and this kept coming to her. And she said in the dream, she never turns around to look at them. She just keeps running. And then a few weeks later, my friend called and she said her daughter told her she decided not to turn away from the monster in her dream, the monsters. And just as she was about to open a door, to close a door to avoid being caught by the monster, she stopped and she looked right at them. There was a bunch of them, and all they did was jump up and down. They didn't move. They just jumped up and down like big bad boys in the same place. And eventually they turned into two-dimensional black and white figures, like cardboard, and collapsed. And that was the last time she had it. She hasn't had that dream since. In running away, when we don't look, we make it real and solid. We make it its thingness much stronger. I think I've told some of you, when I first was sitting, the monitor would come around. You know how we ask for them to adjust our body? And I was sitting with my head slightly turned, and Jimon mostly would come around and she'd do this. And I was like dumbfounded. I mean, the way she placed my head, I felt like it was The Exorcist. It was like almost like, really? Like it was such a turn. And it was just a little. But I realized the more I sat over a year or so, it didn't just go away because she adjusted me, was very subtly there was something I didn't want to look directly at, and I was just subtly going like that. I just couldn't bear to look right in. When we just let things be, whatever we create, it starts to change. It will change. It's fluid. We become more fluid, less suffocated. And we may just drop and see, we're swimming. We're friggin' swimming. We've always been swimming. We've always been in the great supportive ocean. Of course, we can't talk about it or think our way through. We let it be what it is with the whole of our being, and we just wholeheartedly practice it. See the construct. Even if we don't like what we constructed, do we need to wage a war? And there's another resistance we may experience when we hit this place where we lose our connection to the aspiration that brought us to practice. Or it changes and we're wondering, why am I here? What for? Or our expectations of practice are unfulfilled, right? We come to a retreat like this and we want peace and calm immediately and freedom from fear I was after. It's important to understand this vacillation between aspiration and resistance is a natural rhythm of practice. It may feel like we're falling since we're expecting and we're experiencing, and what we're experiencing may feel so much like something, a fixed truth in that moment. And this is the point where sometimes people want to leave. As my teacher, Daito Roshi, said to one woman once who wanted to leave, he says, but where will you go? But where will you go? What are you leaving? Where will you leave to? Doubt in itself is not the problem. The problem comes from identifying with the doubting me and believing this is who I am. If we can stay with the sometimes very excruciating doubts in our life, as practice takes hold and we truly see it's not someplace else, when we're back between the giant monster's fingerprint, then we can learn to use doubt to experience the grief of our unfulfilled expectations of practice. We have it. We grieve that we don't sit down and we're not zapped and calm and peaceful. And then we have to practice. And there's a grief in that, expectations that aren't met. We learn to feel and reside in the physical experience of what doubt feels like in the body instead of the storyline. What does it feel like? Which can and is so difficult. And then we may penetrate right to the bottom. It gives us that. That's the support. We have our own support system. If we can practice these, what we might call obstacles, that's why it's workable, because that's exactly what allows us to penetrate to the bottom. If we can turn towards and face, it's right there. It's always been there. Avalokiteshvara, doing deep prajna paramita, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. As I said in the beginning of session, these images on our altar as we bow, this is you. The wisdom, the compassion, the awakened mind. We raise the Bodhi mind. We raise that aspiration. Thomas Merton expressed this feeling in another way, which may be helpful. True love and prayer are learned when prayer has become impossible and the heart is turned to stone. So he's pointing to the same thing, that we really learn true love and prayer when we feel like it's impossible and our heart has turned to stone. Ain't that the truth? I'm sure we've all been there. Like commitment. Commitment. We find out what commitment is, really, when it's supremely tested. When the gold is in the fire. And the last obstacle, I think I said three, but I feel like there's more. But there's tons. But these are the important ones. I think the last one is the deep-seated desire to feel a particular way. Whether it be calm, spacious, free of anxiety, that this can become an obstacle, this wanting to feel a particular way, especially when we come to retreat. But really, probably most of us share the illusion that if we practice long and hard enough, we'll get what we want. Good health, enlightenment, a satisfying relationship, something, whatever we're seeking. And in some measure, we get what we need. Not always what we want. We get what we need. Truly. And that package is so uncertain. I mean, if you think you know the need package exactly, that could be very surprising. What you think you need and what it actually looks like. And you realize, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, we're not at the gift level yet. This is not a gift. So, you know, don't you hate when someone tells you when something bad happens? It's such a gift. And you just want to go like, ah, here. Take it back. It's horrible. It's one of my bad things. But really, we just don't want to be in pain. We just don't want to be in pain. You know, I've been like reeling lately, and it's like when I go down to it, it's like I just don't want to be in pain. And we think like, oh, like, yes, you can always say like, you know, we had this mosquito episode on our trip into the wild. we went out and sat zazen in the dark, and like they weren't there when we started, but then they came, like really, like immensely, like covering. And you know, we had to do this whole like talk about it because there were all these different reactions and blames, and it was juicy. You know, I painted in my tent that night this huge mosquito with teeth and a sack of blood. Because I had to like process the situation. It was so intense. But one woman said, take stock of your suffering, will you? Like, it's a friggin' mosquito. You don't have cancer. I mean, we know they carry things, but just take stock of what you have, how you're supported in this moment, really. And how do we, it was really good, because it's like, how do we ask for help? How do we call out and say, without being shamed or feel shameful, like, hey, like, I can't take it anymore. Who's going to be the first to say something and receive guidance? You know, it just blows up in our face. So we went through that. We just don't want to be in pain. I see my low tolerance for discomfort often, so we should never underestimate the extent we equate feeling better with being awake. What is really important to Grok is that our life is not about feeling a particular way, nor do we have to be a particular way. All we can do is experience and work with whatever is arising in our life right now and stay present. That is hard to grok. That is really hard to grok. Like, I didn't think that's what life was. To experience and work with whatever is arising in our life and stay present, I did not think that was like the key point of being a human, and to do that with virtue, with kindness and love. To study it through the lens of the Buddha Dharma and realize the ground of being. This way we can really have appreciation for our life just as it is and really find the true refuge. That's most important, that we find refuge in this one, in the one on your seat. A true refuge, not hating yourself at all, at all. Where does that get us? It's deep. We don't have to feel a particular way to be liberated. To be free, we can experience the light of our life, the equanimity that comes with staying truly present with what is. Suchness. On my Roksu, I just want to read this other thing before that. Carl Jung said at the end of his life, I am astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I am distressed, depressed, rapturous. I am all these things at once and cannot add up the sum. And I like this, I want to share. It was important for me this week. A student asked Soen Nakagawa during a meditation retreat, I am very discouraged. What should I do? And Soen replied, encourage others. I am very discouraged. What should I do? Encourage others. So on the back of my Roksu, Shugen Roshi wrote, all things are reality, thusness, mind thusness, sadness and joy thusness, cloud and rain thusness.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.